Hi everyone, Ian Gardner here. Oh, wow, what a show we have for you today. Sam Kronenberg is the CEO and co-founder of A Cloud Guru. A Cloud Guru has just been acquired by a US company called Pluralsight for a rumored $2 billion. So a pretty astonishing outcome. So Aussie company, Sam's based in Melbourne. He co-founded the business with his brother, Ryan, who lives in London. And it's just an amazing story of product market fit and success in terms of getting that product into the hands of customers who are just loving it. It's basically a tool for learning how to use cloud software. So AWS was their first focus, but they're also now doing Google and Azure. And it's just been an astonishing journey. They've got 500 or 600 staff now. Airtree was one of their early investors. And, you know, I want to say a big thank you to James Cameron, who is the investing partner there. James is a good guy and a buddy of mine. And he made the intro to Sam. But Sam, very generous, very smart, very humble, and just incredibly talented. So look, there's a ton of great lessons in here. It takes me a little while. Maybe I was just nervous, but I feel like it took me a little while to get warmed up. But stick with it, because towards the end, there's some just amazing insights and lessons for us all. So here's my interview with Sam Kronenberg. Okay, welcome everyone. I am back with another episode of this podcast. Delighted today to be joined by Sam Kronenberg. I hope I'm pronouncing that right, who is from A Cloud Guru. Now, you may have seen in the press, it was about a month ago, there was an announcement that A Cloud Guru was sold to Pluralsight for somewhere around the $2 billion mark, just around 6 years after he launched it. So I think the largest ever software acquisition of an Australian company. Is that right, Sam?
That's what I hear. Those numbers are not numbers that have been confirmed, and that I can't confirm, but that's certainly what the press
is. It's always tricky. We actually talked about what you can and can't talk about, and I probably opened the questioning with one that was a bit squirmy. It's always difficult, because when you get acquired, there's a lot of restrictions around what you can and can't say. So yeah, apologies for asking that one, Sam.
No worries.
There's a bunch of great outcomes from this. One of your main investors was Airtree, and a few listeners here might have heard you being interviewed by James Cameron last week on the Airtree meetup, which was awesome. So a great outcome for James, the Airtree team, all of the investors, and especially you guys. So, I mean, first of all, before we start, congrats. It must feel pretty good. In fact, how does it feel? I mean, maybe we should start with that question, because you started the business and now you're owned by someone else. How does that feel?
Yeah, look, it feels great. It's very surreal. But every moment of building a high growth startup is surreal. So it's just a new thing to feel, that feels surreal, if that makes sense. It's an emotional thing to go through, because it's your baby, and you wonder whether you want to make the right decisions. But I feel really, really positive about it. I think ultimately with these kind of things, it's, anytime we've hit a fork in the road in the business, we've had to make a major decision. It's always come from ultimately what's going to be better for our customers and what's going to be better for our staff. And I feel absolutely that this is the right decision for both our customers and our staff. So very, very positive about the next chapter.
Yeah, well, fantastic. And congrats again. But let's go a little bit back in time. I just want to hear a bit more about your background. So from what I understand, you grew up in Perth. Perth's kind of a strange town. How was Perth for you growing up?
Yeah, I love growing up in Perth. You know, spent a lot of time outdoors, you know, like causing trouble in the bush, or, you know, just like, it wasn't, we were not a very, I guess, you know, I didn't grow up in like the city. We were, out in the kind of near the, not the countryside, but the edge of the suburbs, and, you know, against the national parks and things. And it's just a great kind of, I feel like it's like the 80s upbringing, you know. I feel like in the 80s, we were kind of the last of the analog generation to grow up, not complete digital natives, but we were right on the edge. So by the time we were teenagers, digital was very much coming. I feel like in my childhood, I got the analog upbringing, got to be outdoors a lot. And then in my teenage and university years, I got the digital upbringing. So I feel like I got the best of both worlds.
Yeah. Cause I mean, you went to uni, you were in Curtin, which is over in Perth. I think it was 02 to 05. You did computer science. I mean, those are the, you know, you must have grown up with the internet and computers around. So it's, how did you avoid getting addicted like most other teenagers nowadays?
Oh, I got addicted.
Oh, you did. Okay.
Well, it was interesting though, but there was none of the negative side. Like there wasn't social media.
Right.
So I remember when I was in grade six, or was it grade seven, and my dad came home and he'd bought us two like 686 computers, you know, and it, like me and my brother, he'd bought us one each and he got us the internet, which nobody had even heard of the internet. Like it was like, what is that? And it was, yeah, it, that just changed my whole world. I stopped reading books. All I ever did was spend time on the computer. And within, I think when I was 13 years old, because I started surfing the internet and you know what the internet was like back then. It was, a series of random people's websites and that was about it. I remember seeing this website this guy in America made and it looked really cool. I loved the look of it. And I literally emailed him. It's like some 35, 40-year-old guy in America. And I emailed him and I said, I want to learn to make websites. Can you teach me? And he emailed me back. And I actually, that was how I learned my first kind of coding, which was, HTML back then.
Yeah.
And he just taught me over email, like a pen pal. And so we didn't have online teaching back then.
That's also, are you still in touch with him?
No. I tried reaching out to him when I got my first job after university at Microsoft to say, hey, look, I made it. Like I'm moving to Seattle to work on build Windows. And, you got me started on this.
Good. If you think that getting a job at Microsoft was getting started, wait till he hears your latest news.
Yeah, that's it. So, my dad was always an entrepreneur growing up and into computers. He owned a computer shop in Adelaide in the 80s, actually.
Oh, yeah.
And so he always really encouraged us both on the entrepreneurial front and the tech front. Really set us up with a good foundation. And strangely, my mum is an educator and worked at the university in training and development. So we ended up at this funny intersection exactly between our parents' careers.
Yeah, right.
Both me and my brother. Yeah.
Well, they must be pretty proud.
Yeah. I think they are.
Yeah. Because the other part that we haven't mentioned is that you did start the business with your brother, Ryan. So I think does he still live in London or is he moving around a bit?
Yeah, he spends a lot of time in Texas as well. So right. he flies back and forward, but he lives in London.
Yeah. What's it like being able to fly?
Oh, I know. He sends me pictures. He's out and about. He's vaccinated. It's like, oh, God.
Now we'll get there. Vaccinated, everyone, if you're listening.
Yeah.
I got my second one on Saturday, so it's in the bag.
Yeah. And if you're not going to get vaccinated, can you send me yours? Because I want one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's talk quickly about your computer science background. So you did, that was your degree. So this is like 02 to 05 at Curtin.
Yep.
From what LinkedIn says, you were pretty academic. So you were top of the class. You won a bunch of awards. Like, is that because you were really smart or did you work harder, a bit of both?
I think it's because I worked harder.
That's what the smartest people say.
That's it. No, sorry. I always remember both at university and high school, I always had a rival that I was trying to beat, or that like get the same or better scores. And, they both, in both cases, they were just more naturally gifted than me, in my view, right? They didn't have to study as hard. They would just turn up. I mean, they'd studied, but I had to do kind of maybe 150% to match them. So, yeah. But it was good. I enjoy a good rivalry. I think it helps. I always studied really hard.
Yeah. So basically 10 years between when you left uni and when you started at Cloud Guru. And I think it's always interesting to think about what amazing founders do in the time between when, because when you left uni, you probably didn't have a vision that in 15 years you'd sell a business for, a few billion dollars.
No.
So what did you and your brother do during that 10 years?
Well, funnily, I always wanted to do some big startup. And I've been building software literally since I was 13. I had my own software company in high school and I would sell shareware on the internet.
Oh, wow.
I would get checks in the mail every month, right, from America. And so I was always, I probably released 5 or 6 different software products in my teenage years. And I spent all of my spare time coding.
What sort of products did you make then?
I wrote a web browser back in the day.
Wow.
Back when it was kind of Netscape and Internet Explorer. And then I made one called Web Prowler, which had about 500,000 downloads.
Wow.
In the early 2000s. I made a Vivo player. I don't know if you ever remember Vivo videos. back before DivX or any of that stuff came out, it was, you could get like a video file that was like 300K. It was completely unwatchable. You couldn't make out anything in the video. But it was like back in the world of dial-up, that was the way videos were shared.
Yeah.
I made a media player, Notepad, anyway, lots of things. But I always wanted to like do a big startup or, you know, build something really significant. But I kind of just, you know, I think in high school, I wasn't good enough at it, right? Like I wasn't a good enough programmer to, business person to really like know what people needed. So I think those years at Microsoft, like post-university, like I think going to university and getting that proper education in programming rather than just what I could find on the internet at the time was really important because, you know, that just the online resources weren't great back then. And then going to Microsoft and learning how to build software that ships at scale and that, you know, is really robust and learn how to do software engineering as engineering.
Yeah.
I think that really set me up. And I think, yeah. And also what I did after Microsoft, I ended up, I traveled, I lived in the UK. I lived in Norway for a year, worked for Microsoft there as well. And then I ended up back in Melbourne, working at a software, consultancy here called Kyandra. Basically, you know, creating custom software solutions for clients. But I ended up doing a lot of, customer liaison and sales there, right? So I'd manage the team and then do the sales. So I think I learned a lot about, how to deal with customers, what customers want, how to sell, how to understand, user needs. And I think all of that came together with, to give me the skill set for Cloud Guru.
Yeah. And what about Ryan? What, your brother, what was he up to at that time?
Yeah. So he was, he has an interesting path. So actually at university, Ryan did business. He wasn't in IT. So I did software engineering and IT. He did business. Strangely, the way we ended up is that I ended up running the business and he ended up teaching IT, which is interesting.
Yeah, spotted that. That's fascinating. Yeah.
But he went on and he did a couple of years as an accountant and then realized he didn't really like it. He did a little bit of visa immigration law. And this is all in the UK, helping Aussies move to Australia. And then ultimately decided to go into IT because he'd always, we both grew up around tech and he loved it. So he moved into the IT industry. When the global financial crisis hit, it wasn't great for Ryan was in immigration and all the immigration stopped and, you know, it kind of wiped out the industry and he was pretty burnt by that. So he thought IT's safe, right? It's the future, going to be fine. So he went and did all his certifications in Cisco and all that. He'd have to tell you, I can't remember what they were. But, you know, in kind of traditional IT infrastructure. And he ended up working at Rackspace and a bunch of different companies in the UK. And then he saw cloud coming, right, and disrupting infrastructure. And he thought, oh, my God, I'm going to go through this again. Like the industry is going to get wiped out by cloud. And so that was in 2014, he thought, well, I'm going to try to get a job with Amazon Web Services, because they're the ones disrupting and I want to be on the bandwagon. And that's how Cloud Guru was born. It was Ryan going through this job interview process to join Amazon. He found it was really difficult to get good training resources to get Amazon certified.
London?
Yeah, this was in London.
Right.
So, you know,
was he going to be a solutions architect or one of the techs?
Yeah, solutions architect. He was going for a solutions architect.
That's a tough job to get. But
yeah,
I mean, I love this story. So like, keep going. I'm just going to let you talk because I did hear this with James and it's amazing.
Yeah. So he went through three rounds. It took like 3 months. It's a long interview process.
That's really typical.
He went through many rounds and he got right to the final round. So most of the training out there when he was trying to learn this to get Amazon certified was like, you know, just take a week off work. Go to a classroom training course for a week. It was like £3,000. And he's like, I got a wife and, you know, a kid. I can't afford to do that. And he was the sole breadwinner in the family. And the online training was all pretty out of date or really dry and boring. So he goes through, he gets to the final round and Amazon turned him down. And he was pretty dejected. I remember at the time he was really, he just felt like he'd been through a lot those last few years. And yeah. But he thought, hey, look, the least I could do is take what I've learned and try to help others who want to get Amazon certified. So he just basically bought a little webcam and a microphone. He spent like £50 on like a little headset. And he just set up in his back room in his flat in London, and he recorded a little course and recorded this screen to show people how to get Amazon certified for the Solutions Architect exam, and put that up on udemy.com. And he tells
for
a story.
For free about, or was it a charge thing?
No, he put it up to charge. Okay. It's like $10 or something. And he actually hadn't done the exam yet, strangely. So he did all of his notes as a course, and then he went into it. Was his way of like getting ready to sit for the exam. And so he made the course, and then he put it up online the morning that he went to the exam. And so he put then he put some like codes on Reddit or something. And then he put, you know, when you go in to do the exam, they make you put your mobile phone like in a locker.
Yeah.
And so he had his mobile phone in a locker, and he put it on silent. And he gets into the exam, and he's in the middle of the exam. And every time someone signed up, the phone would buzz. It would vibrate on the metal cabinet. And so it must have gone off, must have vibrated 200 times while he was sitting that exam. And he's just so distracted. He's like, what is going on? And yeah, it just kind of went crazy from there, honestly. Over the next few months, people just were loving this really. They loved the way he taught. The way that he simplified what you needed to understand.
I mean, that's an incredible lesson in product market fit. I mean, that's a product that he wasn't sure whether people wanted. It was kind of built for himself. He was obviously good at it. And yeah. I think there's some other stories that I'm going to ask you about that shows how good he was. But I mean, that was almost immediate. I mean, that's within an hour of putting your thing live, you've got paying customers. It's astonishing.
Well, that's an interesting model, isn't it? And you know, accessing an existing marketplace to test your product market fit before you go and build a whole big company, you know, try to build a company and all the infrastructure around it. Is there an existing marketplace that you can hit where customers are ready and waiting, and you can test the appetite for it?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's a long way from, you know, getting a couple of hundred signups as a result of posting, you know, a few hours work onto Udemy to, you know, having a companies worth, you know, $1 billion plus. I mean, like, how, I don't know how to phrase this, but you know, some of the lessons in that incredible journey, like what are your takeaways in terms of those toughest phases? You know, was it the early stages before you'd even started, or was it the mid stages of trying to work out how to expand or hire, or was it late stages of trying to, you know, scale and sell?
I feel like for me, the toughest stages were the first couple of years.
Yeah.
It was insane. It was so insane. I just the amount of work required.
Because neither of you had done it before. This is your first business together, wasn't it? I mean, I know you'd had smaller businesses, but you know, this is with a team and funding and all the rest of it.
Yeah, no, this is the first time we'd done it in any kind of scale. Yeah, we'd both tried to run little businesses in the past, but nothing that actually employed many people full time or anything. I really like those first couple of years of just, we just got out there. We threw ourselves at everything. And I think we were kind of fearless about failing, and we were fearless in what we tried. I mean, in the first year of the business, we not only launched our own online learning platform and a whole bunch of training courses on it, you know, trying to sell globally, but we also created a conference business as well. And we started running conferences in person all around the world around serverless technology. So we created a conference called Serverless Conf.
And that's like, a very different business, I'll tell you.
And we were doing both at once. And the way we did that is like, because we built the A-Cloud Guru platform completely serverless. I think we were probably the first really serverless platform at scale.
Right.
Because we were like, we built it before there was a term serverless, and before you could even access Lambda from the web through API Gateway. And so we built everything on top of Lambda, API Gateway, all these different Amazon serverless, you know, they have a nice name now, serverless technologies. And so we were part of this community that was just like pioneering at the time. We were, you know, working with all different, you know, thought leaders in the community who were pushing the state of the art forward here. And then we had this moment of like, hey, why don't we launch a, like, why don't we have a conference to bring this community together and help each other? And so we literally just booked a warehouse in Brooklyn. We'd never run a conference. We didn't know what we were doing. We were, you know, an Aussie and Brits doing this. And we just booked a warehouse in May 2016 in Brooklyn. And we just sent invites to people on Twitter to say, hey, why don't you come to our conference on serverless? It's going to be great. And people started buying tickets. And then we started selling. We put a sponsorship pack together. And we had Amazon, Adobe, Microsoft, Capital One. The list of sponsors was nuts, absolutely nuts. And these like 300 people turn up at this tiny warehouse in Brooklyn and we just put on a conference. Right? It was crazy, but it was like this real, like everyone was in it together. Everything was like new and exciting, you know, at that stage, and like cloud was really taking off and everyone was really excited about it.
And I'm sure it was good for your cash flow and profitability. I mean, getting a niche conference right at that scale, I mean, you can do really well.
Yeah, no, we never made any money. Right, okay. But
you didn't charge enough for the sponsorship. That's my takeaway.
We always grappled with, should we be doing this? And I think there's a few things like this, like going to meetups. Like we were always going to meetups, speaking, getting out there. And for the first couple of years, there was this constant conversation, like, are we just distracting ourselves from the real business here, which is a digital online business selling training? And we always, like, it was a constant source of tension the first couple of years. But when you get further down the track and you look back at all of the incredible relationships that came from those first couple of years of just getting out there, beating down the doors, being at every event and every meetup and all of the, what that then went on, you know, the butterfly effects from that, they're absolutely incredible.
Yeah. I think it's a super important topic. I didn't have this in my list, but I think we should talk about it. I mean, you know, when I see software startups, I mean, often they come out of people who are doing consulting, you know, so they're consulting in some form and they build a product to fit their need. And the reality is for the first few years or, you know, the first few months even, they're running both at the same time. You know, so you got your software arm, which all the VCs love and everyone generally loves because it's, you know, recurring, sticky, high margin, revenue. But you've also got this rather annoying consulting piece on the other side, which is just, it's cash and it's credibility and it's learning and the customer. And at a certain point, you kind of have to split the two. But, you know, I'm probably more, you know, and I actually had this experience when I was running my software business. We had a, you know, we were doing, it was like a video platform. We had a webcasting arm in the side and we kept running it. We ran it the whole time. And it was just this constant cash cow. You know, so I'm more in the camp of, look, if you can make your consulting business work for you and provide cash, then keep it running. Did you keep it running or what ended up happening? And any other observations on that point?
We kept running the conference for until COVID hit, basically. But we were planning to kind of partner with another organization to start running it for us because it is like the actual – what we found value was from the networks, not the actual, the conference wasn't providing a lot of money, right? It was profitable, but it wasn't significant compared to the broader company. What was really valuable was the networks. So we wanted to move to a model where we didn't have to run all the logistics, but we still had access to the networks, but that all kind of fell apart with COVID. So that conference we're not running anymore.
So it's not just AWS that you support now. Are you doing training for other cloud partners? I mean, like how broad is the Cloud Guru's reach now?
Yeah, so we teach training education for all major clouds for Amazon Web Services, Microsoft Azure, and Google Cloud. We have a lot of content on all of those platforms, and they're all like first class citizens in the platform. The first couple of years, Amazon was where our focus was, and then we moved into Azure and then into Google. And now we have as much education on Azure as AWS, for example, and Google's a very close second.
Yeah. Um,
So we do all three. And look, businesses want all three. You know, most, nearly every enterprise we deal with is in at least two clouds. So it's important that they have one place they can go. And, you know, they can get that independent advice, right?
Let me ask a different question. So like when I was at AWS, so I spent 4 years running the startup team there for Australia, New Zealand, 2014 to 2018. You know, yep. So the job was terrific. You basically, you know, handed out credits and support and advice to the best startups and hung out with the VCs. And you kind of just got to know the whole ecosystem. But I was constantly phoned by VCs or contacted by VCs who were seeing this explosion of startups in the space of, you know, providing kind of tangential services to the AWS offering, you know, and I'd put you in that camp as well. I mean, in theory, Amazon should be providing training in the way that you are. In theory, Amazon should have a billing engine that is, you know, easy to use and has full clarity. In theory, they should make it easier to provision your spot instances. I mean, but there are startups emerging all the time. And a lot of the VCs loved the look of it because the numbers were great and the margins were high and their traction was incredible. But they're worried about Amazon's ability in theory to, you know, do a sideways step. And if you're a gorilla and you step sideways and you can easily crush some ants. Did you see this as a problem, especially when you're raising your money, and how did Airtree and others see through the fact that it was sustainable?
It was always a big question in fundraisers, for sure. It wasn't actually a problem day to day in running the business, but it was always something that investors had to get comfortable with. I think ultimately this is what we do, and this, you know, we could show that this is what the market are choosing us for, right? There are like, they'd always say, what if, you know, Amazon or Google or Microsoft stepped in and really, really push at this market? And my answer was always, well, they do. They have. Like, they've been doing it longer than us, right? Like, and a lot of it's free. But customers still choose a Cloud Gurus training because of all of the value that we provide. And, you know, I think the biggest thing here is that we are moving, if you think of the big trends that are happening, the world is moving. Like cloud, software is rewiring the world, but cloud is the underpinning of that, right? And what is cloud? It's a managed service. So that means that everything is moving. It's you're basically just sitting on top of a moving target. So everything you're building on top of is changing all the time, every day. It's not like where you used to install infrastructure in the past and you'd upgrade the server every 4 years and then you'd go and, oh, okay, I got to learn this new software application. Let me go take a training course or read a book. Now the software's changed, your platform's changing underneath you every day. And so we're moving to a world where education has to be continuous. People need to integrate learning and work just constantly. Yeah. And when you think it, like, it seems really obvious, but I don't think many people have actually really thought about this in depth. Education hasn't really changed in what, 50 years. I mean, we pretty much do it the same way. Ultimately, if we're now moving to a world where the technologies that we need to use to compete are changing every day and moving really fast, and we need to learn really fast, how do you get people to do that? You got to make it fun.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
It's pretty much as simple as that. Make learning enjoyable. Make it something people want to do rather than have to do, and then they'll succeed. And that's what our whole focus has been. Make the learning interesting, exciting, engaging, because the technologies are. And that was always the reply to the VCs, right? Which is, hey, this is what we do. And I remember once in a pitch, I was asked, yeah, okay, but why won't they just copy that, right? And my response was, look at HBO. Like, yeah, they succeed because they make amazing content. Why doesn't someone else just go and copy that? Why don't the other channels just go and make amazing content? Because it's really hard to do.
Great response.
It's really hard to do.
Yeah.
It's not something you can just, I'm just going to apply the playbook and copy and, you know, make another Game of Thrones. You have to actually have a special, like a secret sauce and an understanding of how to do that.
The reality is that your product was just a lot better. I remember if you could tell that story where you'd taken a stand at the internal AWS sales kickoff. Oh, yeah. There's tens of thousands of Amazon employees. And yeah, like, take it from there, because I think this is an amazing story.
Yeah. So the funny thing is we've taught a lot of Amazon employees. I mean, I think there's something, I think it's over 50,000 Amazon employees on the platform.
Is that before they got the job, or are you still teaching them even after?
No. This is up. So, you know, Ryan wanted the job there. He didn't get the job. And then, you know, we created the company. And then, you know, always the thing we've noticed is how many Amazon employees tell us they learned Amazon from using our training. And then a couple of years ago, we were invited out to Amazon's internal kickoff meeting, which is like a conference of like 20,000 people.
Was it in Vegas?
In Chicago.
That was just after I left. We used to do it in Vegas. It was horrible. Oh my God.
Yeah.
Yeah. Once you've been to Vegas twice a year for 4 years, it's brutal. It's the worst place in the world.
Oh yeah. It's not fun. I go to all the re-invents and it gets a bit old. And so we're there and we have a booth there, this kickoff. And then we have this line of Amazon employees who are lining up at the booth to meet us and to get they usually want to get a selfie with my brother, Ryan, because he's the face of they've all spent like 40 hours with him, like learning, doing their training, listening to him. And there's a line of, it was 100 people deep, 100 people waiting in line to get a selfie, like for hours. Like it just kept about that size.
That's amazing.
And they're all Amazon employees, and every single one would come up and say, "Hey, I just want to say thank you because I got my job at Amazon because of you," right? And it's like, well, amazing. It's not because of us, but they did the training. I pulled Ryan aside and I'm like, the irony of this, it just hit me all at once. I'm like, you didn't get the job, but all of these people did. All got the job that you wanted.
I love that story. I mean, I think it's just so compelling, and it just shows that there's so much of startup world is down, fortune and luck plays a big role. I mean, you've got to be in the game to win it, so sure, there was a bit of luck there, but if you combine luck with talent, you can be just amazingly successful.
And this was maybe another anecdote along that line, so that I haven't told before. In the first month or so of the business, we got invited to go to Web Summit. Have you heard of Web Summit? Yeah, out of Ireland. And we didn't know what was going to come of it, but we thought, hey, we'll go, because we're just in that mode of just try everything and see what works. And so we went to Web Summit, and it's like this big startup convention in Dublin. And they say, hey, there's going to be all these VCs there, and you can get funding and blah, blah, blah. None of that worked out for us. We sat there on this line. We were like one startup with a tiny little booth in a row of like 100 trying to pitch ourselves. And we stood there for a day, and it was very depressing. And we're like, why are we here? This is crazy. And then at the end of the day, we're like, let's go and have a drink at Temple Bar. So we get the only way to get back to Temple Bar is on a bus, because all the cabs and Ubers are maxed out. So many people there. And so we're lining up for the bus, and we go and we sit on the bus, and this guy sits in front of us, and he's an Aussie guy. He notices our accents, and we start chatting. And it turns out that he grew up one suburb next over from Ryan and I in Perth.
Oh, wow.
And he went to the same high school as our stepbrothers. And we're chatting to him. And then it turns out that he works for a big like venture debt firm in London. And, so we get his card, and we went and had a drink with him at Temple Bar. He's a really cool guy. And then Ryan caught up with him in London over the next couple of months. And when we raised our Series A about a year and a half later, we were connected to him, and he introduced us to a couple of other VCs who came into the process and made really compelling offers and actually pushed our valuation up by $10 million in the Series A round. Just from sitting on the bus with this guy in Dublin.
I used to say that to the salespeople that worked for me, because it asked me, should I go to this? And I'm like, look, I don't know, but if you don't go, I guarantee nothing happens. You've got to
exactly. And sometimes you go and nothing happens.
Yeah.
Right. Like probably at least half the time, nothing does happen.
Yeah.
It's like being locked down. It's always a tension. Yeah.
So yeah, because Amazon's, I just want to touch on the whole B2B aspect. So Amazon is now, because you started B2C, but now you're B2B and Amazon's a big customer. Like, I mean, can you maybe touch on that transition and where most of your money's coming from now?
Yeah, so we moved, we added B2B. So we're still very B2C company, but we transitioned to add B2B and that's been a very successful transition. I mean, we got to this point in 2017 where we had hundreds of thousands of B2C customers and they were saying, hey, I want to buy this for my team. I want to train my team. I don't want to have to buy them all individual licenses. I want to see what they're doing. And so it was a kind of a natural pull from our customers to build a B2B offering. And that's actually why we decided to raise a Series A, because we were a profitable bootstrapped company. We never actually spent the money from the raise, but what we wanted was expertise to help us build an enterprise SaaS business, right? Like, and we're both IT guys, tech guys, so we knew the product and market inside out, but did not know how to build a sales force. And that was something our Series A partners, who are Elephant VC out of Boston, were really able to help us with. They helped us hire our first US employee, our COO, John Meachin, who basically, you know, was our eyes and ears on the ground in the US to build up our US presence, which was all of our apart from our European sales force, the rest of our go-to-market workforce.
Yeah, that's because getting that first hire right, especially in a market like the US, I mean, the US is littered with the carcasses of Australian companies that think it's going to be easy to expand there. And the reality is it's bloody difficult, you know, because it's not just one big market, but there's lots of sub markets and it's a little bit cliquey. I mean, how important was that first hire?
Oh, hugely important. I mean, even he was like, he had actually worked for an Aussie company helping them move to the US previously. And he said, don't go to San Francisco, because we did that. And we thought we were going to rock up in San Francisco and everyone's going to work for us because we were the cool company in Sydney, right? And everyone wanted to work for us in Sydney. But when we got to San Francisco, no one cared. Right? And suddenly it was really hard to hire. And, you know, just having advice like that from the start was fantastic.
And where did you end up? Because I know you did a bit of a beauty parade to work out which city to open in. Where was that?
Yeah, we ended up in Austin, Texas. Right. And, you know, it's probably a little different now because the market's so hot there now, everyone's moving in. But when we moved in 2017, when it was like, you know, it was becoming a hub. And it was just, it's been such a fantastic city to operate out of. There's a lot of good SaaS companies there who have gone the journey that we wanted to go on, right? And had some big exits. So, you know, when companies do that, they train a lot of really good talent in, you know, scaling demand gen and, you know, product marketing and all the things that, you know, a good SaaS focused sales force. And so, yeah, you get those kind of economies of scale, and we were able to pick up really, really great talent. In that
market. So, I mean, one of the things we see with, you know, Innovation Bay runs a group for late stage or later stage, you know, you are definitely late stage, but later stage. So $20 million plus, founders called Summit, you know, and there's some commonality amongst what a tech founder like that needs to do. And it kind of falls into three buckets. So the first one is funding, you know, so they're always raising money. And, you know, what do they raise money for? It's to hire people. So that's the second thing they have to do, is just, they're basically hiring all the time. And then the third thing they've got to do is this, you know, kind of expansion. You know, that's a pretty broad term. I mean, do you want to touch on each of them? Like, so maybe we should dig into each one in turn. I mean, starting with funding, I mean, like, because you've now been in a pretty extraordinary funding journey. You know, you're bootstrapped, you raised money, and now you've been through an acquisition. So do you want to touch on that experience for you?
Yeah, we raised a Series A, a Series A with Elephant out of Boston, Series B with Summit Partners out of Boston, and Airtree came in on that round. And then we did a Series C we acquired our competitor, Linux Academy, and we had Elephant, Summit, Airtree, and then Bain Capital come in to fund that. So yeah, have raised money many times. It never gets easier.
Does it get harder though?
No.
Is it just different?
No, it doesn't. It didn't get harder. It's probably fair. Maybe it does get, Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it does get a little bit easier when you're third round. But I was surprised. Series B surprised me because Series A was, you know, a lot of work and, you know, that's your kind of your proof. That was our first proof point. You know, kind of felt like once you got over Series A, suddenly everything flipped. Suddenly now everybody's coming to you and saying, hey, we want to get to know you. We want to invest. We want to be an investor. It's this weird thing. Before someone else invests, no one wants to know you. Once someone invests, everyone wants to know you. So I think just given how much outreach we had from, you know, dozens of VCs around the world after our Series A, I thought Series B would be kind of like a shoe-in, like really easy to do. And the business was growing so fast. So I think that was probably the surprise for me. We went and did this pitch all over San Francisco for Series B to kind of all the best investors who'd been following us for a long time. And I was expecting to get, you know, frankly, I was expecting to get a whole bunch of offers coming in, right? Just because the business was going well. These people had been interested in us for so long. And then they started dropping like flies. And it was very shocking to me.
Wow.
And we ended up getting some good offers, but like just the initial reaction was just love it, but not sure about the size of this market long-term. Too niche, maybe too niche, or even just things like check size is wrong for us. Like often like, hey, you're not raising enough money. It's just not a fit for us as a firm.
Yeah.
We only do 50 million plus check sizes. So yeah, it was just, I think that was a lesson for me.
And you made a small, what I thought was a small comment before, but I think it's pretty telling. Like when you raised one of these rounds, you said you didn't actually need the money or deploy it. Mm. And so is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. That was Series A. Series B, even then we didn't, I'm not sure we ever spent it, but it gave us buffer. It gave us buffer for aggressive expansion, knowing that we had that money in the bank if we need.
And the punchline there is like you just had product market fit and a really, you know, cash generative, you know, slash profitable business that you were running.
Yes. Yeah, that's it. That's it. And we just, what we wanted to do why we raised was we wanted to invest ahead. We wanted to have the buffer to know that we're going to invest ahead of sales in like the B2B product, in the B2B sales force. And we, you know, we want to grow sales with it so we don't have to spend it. But if we've got the buffer, if we need to.
Yeah. Look, you don't have to answer this one, but did you and Ryan take any cash off the table on any of those rounds that came through?
We took cash off the table every time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you want to touch on that? Because a lot of investors can be a bit hard ass on it. It's like, no, we don't, you know, the money's going in the business, not for you. Like why is it good for founders to take money off the table?
It's so good. It's the best thing you can do, I think, because it removes some of the pressure. It removes poor decision-making due to stress.
Right.
I think. So we, you know, even at Series A, took enough that it was more than we kind of ever thought we would have made. When we set out to do the business, it was more than we'd ever kind of dreamed that the business would give us, right? And so then I just think it's so important because it does depend on your risk profile. But for us, you know, I wanted to make sure my family were looked after and like no matter what happened, we had a really, really solid future. And I think that when you then get into, so like when we went through the acquisition process recently and sold the company, I didn't have that pressure of thinking, oh my God, everything's on the line here. If I screw this up or it doesn't work, it's back to square one. Like we were fine. It was not going to be an issue for us.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
Financially. And then I was able to make a really sane decision about our customers and our staff and what was actually the right strategic future for the company and not what was going to be good financially for me personally.
Yeah. We'll maybe save the question of your acquisition by Pluralsight until we just finish this quick round of the recruitment and expansion. But I want to just run through those three. So funding, understand, I mean, it's tough, but important. Recruitment. I mean, like that money comes in or, you know, in your case, you've got cash anyway and you are recruiting. So yeah, I mean, you've got 500 or 600 staff now. I mean, like you have hired a lot of people. So tell us about recruitment and how you think about it.
Yeah. So we went early. We hired our first people and culture hires early specifically so that we could gear up for fast growth. So we hired.
So how early? Like how many staff did you have when you had your first HR person?
25.
Okay.
We hired our first HR person, 25 people. And then their job was to build a recruiting team. So we hired Zara Zabukovac, who was actually the head of talent from Airtree. She was leaving Airtree at the time to move to Melbourne. And her background is recruiting. She was ran recruiting at LinkedIn. And so we wanted someone with that background. And so then she built a really, really solid recruiting team. And it was the best decision we made. Having full-time recruiters in the business versus trying to use contractors going outsource to an agency, like you just can't afford it. It's like $20,000 or $30,000 a head to hire people through an agency. And I'm so glad we didn't because I don't see how we could have. I mean, it would have just burned cash. And just having great recruiters and who know the business and can just scale really effectively is important. And I think might not be that useful for other businesses, but for us, we had a unique challenge of hiring online teachers because our model was to hire engineers to become online teachers. So we're basically hiring people who'd never ever thought about being an online teacher before to come and teach. So we had to learn how to hire people into that role and show them what it's going to be like and get them excited about it. So that was a whole other challenge.
And look, I love asking good founders this or great founders this question just about culture. You have built a strong team and a strong culture. Like, how have you done it?
So I think initially it was just, so it was initially just kind of hiring the right people. But then what we did was we codified our values really early and we spent a lot of time on that. And so we wanted to institutionalize the values of the company as we scaled recruiting to make sure that every hire you make is living and breathing the values of the company. So I guess an example here. So we spent time codifying our values at that when we had like 30 people. And we spent about a year trying to get that right. And we refined it for another 2 years, but it took us about a year to get our values really nailed. But they're not like those one liners you see on a wall, respect, accountability, those kind of things. It's like champion our customers, learn all the things, it's the humble but hungry. The things that like we really looked at the team that we had was we had our early team, our team now is amazing. Our early team were fantastic and we just looked at them and we I didn't do it myself. I actually think it's good if the founder doesn't build the values. And that's what Sarah really encouraged me to do. We actually had our people build the values, look at, hey, like, why did you join the company? What resonated with you? Why are you here? What are the attributes of our most successful employees?
And how big was your team when you codified these values?
We started at about 30. I think it took us a year to really nail it. So we probably had 70 or 80 people by then. But our first cut at it was when we were 30 or 40.
And it's impossible to put these artificial metrics on it. But so you hired your first HR person like to build out your recruitment team at 25 staff and you started building your cultural norms at about 30. Do they feel like the right thing for most founders?
I would, because there's nothing, in my opinion, there's nothing more important than the values of your people and how they behave, because values drive behaviors. And ultimately, like, so the example here is, it's a bit of a tangent, but I think it's a solid example, is marketing. Like, I originally did all of the marketing for the company. I would write the emails. I would write the copy on the website. And like, I was an engineer selling to engineers. And so then when we hired a marketing team, I really struggled with like, well, how do we get a marketing team to relate to our customers and speak with the same voice, right? And for a long time, I thought we're going to have to fake it. We're going to have to teach them to, fake it to speak like an engineer. Or do we put engineers in the marketing team? This was what I was grappling with. And what I realized over time is that it's actually about the values. It's not about teaching someone to fake it. It's not even about being an engineer. It's about having the same kind of behavior, like the way that you operate and your values, that kind of down-to-earth humbleness, that hunger to learn, that curiosity. If you hire people that exhibit those values, and you get them all across your company, then your whole company, everybody touches a customer in some way, then you're going to have a level of consistency in how your company acts and portrays itself to the market. So I think that was my big learning, is it's actually about hiring the right people that, you know, so as you scale, you're effectively mimicking, hiring people that are similar to your early stage founding team in the way that they think about the world and the way that they treat others and the way that they interact.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. No, that's great. Yeah. I mean, this is great advice. I mean, I love when there's, you know, takeaways for the audience from what we're talking about. Another one that could be a takeaway, because most people haven't been through it, but you now have, is that the question of the sales process, the acquisition by Pluralsight. You know, because for those that don't know, it's not a case of someone phoning you and saying, "Hey Sam, we want to buy your business. Come in tomorrow, we'll hand you a check." I mean, there's a sort of a dance, and you know, even once the process is done, it's not actually done, because you know, you're normally locked in. I mean, how did it all start? And maybe just give us a little bit of insight, or how much you can share about the process.
Yeah, I probably need to be. I have to choose my words, I guess.
Sorry, you can edit it out afterwards.
Yeah, no worries. By the way, tradies at my house, and there's quite a lot of noise outside, so I don't know if you.
No,
can
we
hear
can't
that.
Hear it. So yeah, all good for now.
Yeah, you know, when you run a business like this, you get a lot of inbound requests, you know, related to acquisition. They happen every few months or every quarter for many years. And, you know, there's definitely a spectrum of like those who are just keeping you warm versus those who are really, really interested. So it's not like a one-off thing that just suddenly starts, right? It's like, this is an ongoing trickle over time for a long time. But yeah, we had a point where we had suddenly like a burst of activity, like it really amped up more significantly. And we had several inbounds all come in at once. And I think I realized that at that point that there a lot of different players in our market were seeing the same opportunities around consolidation. And they're all approaching it from slightly different angles, but everybody's seeing the same opportunity to build. Like there isn't actually a big winner in ed tech yet, right? You know, that really big winner that you know, that most markets have. There's a lot of fragmentation. So I think a lot of people saw the opportunity to create more value for customers by bringing you know, some of the players in different verticals together to create a you know, a more successful platform at scale for customers. So I think, yeah, that was, we had quite a lot of activity ramp up and at once. And then I thought, hey, this is, in a sense, that was part of some of the decision-making process. This is happening. Whether or not we do this, this is going to happen for other companies. So then thinking through, well, what does that dynamic in the market play out to be 5 years down the track? And is that a good or a bad thing for us as a standalone company? Because ultimately I care that we are like providing the best platform possible for our customers and, you know, great opportunities for our staff moving forward. And yeah, I always try to project forward. Well, ultimately where are we going to end up in a better place 5 years down the track?
And I mean, how does the negotiation dance go? I mean, again, you don't have to go into specific examples, but just broadly.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's hard because it's very intense. It's the most intense thing you ever go through. It's way more intense than raising money because we had a very competitive process too, right?
So you did run a process.
Yeah, there was a process, and it was very competitive, and so there was just a lot going on. And a lot of interaction. And
Did you have advisors in that, or is that just you and your team?
Yes. Yeah, we had advisors. Okay. We had JP Morgan advising us.
Okay, cool.
It's basically like sprinting a marathon.
That sounds brutal.
You are running so hard. I mean, there was a week in that process. Like it had been months already. And then there was a week where I slept between 4 a.m. and 6 a.m. each night. And that was my sleep. And then I would get another 2 hours sleep between 3 and 5 p.m. in the afternoon. And that went on for a, like, I was 2 months into this process at that point, and then that went on for a week.
That doesn't sound healthy.
I was pitching it, you know, or doing due diligence meetings at 3 a.m., 2 a.m. It was just nuts. And so, yeah, it was, no, it's not healthy, but it's kind of, it's just what you have to do. And so then you, you know, you're emotional because you're sleep deprived. It's a huge decision. You don't want to, you know, ultimately it is on you to make the call. And you don't want to make the wrong call. So it's very, very intense. But, oh man, like, you know, you learn so much through doing that.
And did you manage to keep alignment with Ryan and your investors during that process?
Yeah, yeah. Our investors were amazing. I know everybody gets worried. You know, when I brought on VCs, I got worried because I didn't know. I'd never done it before. And everybody gets worried about their VCs, like, you know, forcing them to do things they don't want to do or strong-arming them. I mean, my VCs could not have been more opposite. They were incredibly supportive. They were happy for, they literally, Sam, you make the call. It's your call.
Yeah.
If you want to sell or not, we support either way. If you want to, you know, who you want to sell to, we support, even, you know, yeah, I won't go into detail, but they were just so incredibly supportive.
No, that's so great to hear.
Absolutely fantastic board.
All right. Look, we're over time from where I said we're going to be. You know, I promised you that we'd be out in 50 minutes. We're now almost an hour in. One last question and then we'll jump into the quick fire round. And again, it was kind of the last thing you said in the conversation you had with James Cameron last week. And I think it was, you know, we can do this from Australia. You know, so can you touch on that and just give us some, you know, because being an Australian startup is tough, but it's still doable. Yep. You can build an amazing business from here. Like, why do you believe that?
Yeah, well, I believe it because we did it.
Yeah, there you go. That's a good answer.
and you look at the ecosystem, you know, that's growing now. It's so exciting. So when I moved to Australia, back to Australia in 2010, I was pretty despondent. I'd worked all over the world at Microsoft and different places, and there was all these incredible software projects to work on. And I got back here and I found it pretty uninspiring. I mean, there were some things that were interesting, but most things were not have, you know, global impact products. It was mostly building things for the local market. And
2010 was a wasteland.
Yeah, it was horrible. And that was when I got super passionate about, we need to build great software companies here. And it took me another 5 years to get one off the ground. I spent a few years on another one that failed. But yeah, I think we can do it. But we have to also not kid ourselves that it's going to be a little bit harder for us because we have the tyranny of distance, the tyranny of time zones. But we can do it. And you know, we've got great talent here. We've got great expertise. And I think it's just learning how to enter other markets and how to think global from day one. I think that's the key. You can't just try to win Australia. It's not like, and then expand out. You got to think global from day one. You got to compete with the best US and European companies from day one. But there's no reason we can't do it.
Well, I might use that as a little bit of a segue to ask the first quickfire question. And I'm going to cheat a bit because the question's about your favorite tech CEO, but I'm going to add Australian to that. So who's your favorite Australian tech CEO?
Oh, I am terrible at this because I don't spend a lot of time following this world. I've been so focused on running my own business.
That's the right answer, you know.
CEO.
Yeah, the best founders, you know, it's like your head's in your own tin bucket that you're hitting with a hammer every day.
Yeah, I mean, I've met a bunch. It would be very hard for me to say who my favorite is in Australia. Yeah.
And what was your answer going to be for any tech CEO?
I'll give you it's the worst answer ever. And everybody will think I'm so cliched, but I was going to say Elon Musk.
Well, the cliched ones are either Elon Musk or Jeff Bezos. So it's kind of the...
Yeah. And the reason is just not... I just like that his first principles thinking. I think ultimately, like, there is startups from the outside, but successful businesses can look so complex. And like you look at them and think, how do they ever build this? But actually, there's just usually one like core underlying nugget of truth that drives the whole success of that business. And I love the way he thinks, you know, like, hey, well, what if we made rockets reusable? That'd be a lot cheaper.
Yeah.
Right. Like, that's it. Yeah. That's the business. Right. And there's all of this complexity built on top of that. But I love that thinking.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that is, All right, well, let's keep rolling on with the questions. So have you got a favorite book that you want to tell us about?
I'm going to go cliched again. I love Sapiens by Yuval Noah Harari. I just love that perspective on the history of humanity and how we got here. And I just think we lack so much perspective these days. We only see the last 40 years and nothing happened before that.
And did you prefer that? Because he wrote a sequel, Homo Deus. So, and I'm sure you
Homo Deus was good. It was good. I like that. But I really love Sapiens. I think giving you the 3 million year perspective on humanity and even the fact that there were other species, you know, of humans is fascinating.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. What about podcasts? Do you listen to podcasts?
Yeah, I love Lex Fridman. He is my man. Do you know Lex Fridman?
No, you're the first to mention him. I'm going to go and look him up.
He does like science and physics. I love science and physics. And so he's started straying into tech now. So he's a MIT PhD. I think he's a professor or lecturer or something there in machine learning and, AI, self-driving cars, that kind of thing. But he created this podcast interviewing like the top minds in science and physics. So he interviews like the best of the best, you know, like Roger Penrose and
that's awesome.
Stephen Wolfram and just amazing people. He has Elon Musk on as well. Wow. And he's the intersection of science and tech. It's really good.
And you read the Quanta publication? You came across that?
What's that called?
Quanta.
No, I don't know that.
You should check it out. It's basically maths, computer science, biology. I think James Cameron put me onto it a while ago.
Oh, really? Oh, I'll have to read it.
You'd love it. All right, we'll check that out. I've even got a podcast link to it. Favorite news source? Like, how'd you stay in touch with things?
For tech news, I love Ars Technica. Right. I've read that for probably 20 years. I love it. For other news, honestly, I'm pretty boring. I'll read a bit of everything. The Age in Australia, Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal. I just try to get a bit of everything.
Yeah, nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
Do you have a favorite app? So this is when you pull your phone out and you're not working.
So maybe because of what I do, my favorite apps are not apps that I always use, but they're apps that I have a lot of respect for the craft of building them. So I love Calm, the app Calm. I just love apps that understand their user and craft a feeling. It's not just a function, but it's a feeling. Like they understand like, hey, why are you coming to use Calm? It's because you're trying to relax, you're trying to go to sleep, and everything about it from the moment you open it with the crickets chirping in the background, the light blue kind of haze and stars behind, and then mixing that with awesome content, because they kind of like Acloud Guru, they're a content business as well. So the fact that they've got like Kate Winslet reading stories and all these, famous names, there to kind of let Matthew McConaughey to lull you off to sleep. It's just this really fascinating, interesting kind of blend of great software, great experience, and incredible content that keeps you hooked and interested, because they're always bringing in, new, really interesting people that to read your stories.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
Productivity tool.
I think you've probably had people say this before, but probably Superhuman is my best productivity tool. So that's an email. That's an email client.
Yeah, I tried it. I couldn't work out why it was better than Gmail. I can see why it worked for others, but it kind of didn't work.
To me, it's like because I'm a coder, I'm not sure if you are, but no. I love, it's like an IDE. It's like a development environment for email. And I realized because I've moved from programming to being a CEO, I spend all my day in emails, and it's kind of like having a coding environment for emails. So everything's keyboard based. I don't ever use the mouse. Everything's like fast shortcuts.
Yeah.
And I can kind of feels a little bit like programming my email.
Yeah, I get it.
Yeah.
TV show, do you have time to watch telly?
Not a lot. But again, my three favorite things are tech, science and physics, and politics. I think they're the things I could have gone into any of them. And so my favorite TV show of all time is The West Wing.
There you go.
I love that show. It's so good. Yeah, it's good. a bit dated now. You can tell I'm not watching TV much anymore.
Hopefully you'll start getting a bit more time.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have an acquisition process to go through. You just got to run a business. It's much easier. And very last question, like if you got asked by TED to do a talk, you know, one of those 15-minute lightning talks, what would you talk about?
Okay. If I wanted to relate it to things I actually know very well, I would do something on the future of education and work. Like, what are the obvious truths in education about how it needs to change that nobody is talking about right now, but are actually extremely obvious when you think about it? Like, you know, the potential death of universities, shift to learning being integrated with work, and some of those big trends. So I think that's what I would, you know, talk about something I actually know. If I wanted to talk about something I didn't know, but I would love to learn to give a speech on, it would be the biggest and the most exciting ideas in physics on, like, why do we exist, right? And I would love to be able to distill that down into human, like, very understandable, plain English language, because there's so much going on here around, like, the nature of consciousness, the different theories of everything that are coming out. But there's, like, a lot of very hard to understand complex ideas. And I think being able to distill that down into 10, 20 minutes of, like, where is humanity moving on these, on some of the kind of deepest philosophy of why we exist, I would love
to. Yeah, no, I love that. I mean, that's, I think you and I share some base passions here. You know, I've been trying to do a bit more reading around that stuff. And it's an incredible world that we live in. And the more we can understand it, the better.
Yeah. So, but I'm not qualified to give that speech.
Yeah. No, not to worry. I'm sure you get there at some point. Anyway, look, Sam, we are definitely over time. Look, I really, really enjoyed that. I really appreciate that you gave up the time to do it, especially while you got a renovation going on in the background.
No worries.
Congrats on the acquisition. And yeah, look, good luck with the ongoing process. Anything you'd like to ask our audience to, you know, do you want to get in touch, or you've got jobs going? I mean, like, yeah, what do you want to say?
Yeah, we're always looking for great people who are interested in, you know, engineers and product managers and tech folks in Australia for helping build the ACLAD Guru platform, now part of Pluralsight, and anyone who's interested in online teaching as well. Yeah, get in touch with us.
All right, and the website's what?
It's acladguru.com.
All right, easy peasy. Yeah. Sam, thank you so much. And thanks everyone for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Great, thank you so much.